From Glitch HQ on Riverside Avenue in Modified, Prepared, Minneapolis, this is Nice Games Club, the show where nice game devs talk gaming and game development. I'm Martha McGarry, and I make nice games.
I'm Stephen McGregor, and I make nice games.
And I'm Mark LaCroix, I too make nice games.
For this week's episode, our topics are modding games and self-publishing must-haves. And so, if everyone is ready,
let's start.
Woo!
So, Stephen, news in your world.
Yes. Treasure Stack. Was at PAX. Was at PAX.
Yeah.
And we are also on the Switch.
Hey.
So, yeah.
I had to keep that news held for a very long time. So, I don't think I did a good job. And in fact, my brother would regularly like give me faces because he knew I was telling people. I didn't tell that many people, though. It didn't get out. I don't think so. Yeah.
You didn't say it on the podcast.
I didn't say it on the podcast. Well, until now.
Right. Well, yeah.
Which but, is, it's safe
and
now.
We're recording this now before the announcement.
Don't tell people that.
Well, I'm saying, I mean, we'll keep it under lock and key, but yes. Like, you're very nervous.
Yeah. Yeah, I had a snafu earlier this week about the secret, but it did get out probably. Yeah. So that's why I'm nervous.
Right.
Yeah. In the future episode, we could talk about like releasing games on consoles and stuff because it's definitely interesting.
Yeah,
whole lot of cool stuff.
Right. You know, we talked about that last week. You know that.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, we talked about pitching it.
Okay. You just sound like it's totally out of context, but yeah. Oh yeah, for sure. Because like, that's step one.
Yeah.
And then we got to have because you've got this experience that is incredibly valuable, and now you're a little more free to talk about it.
Yes.
So that's really exciting.
Yeah, yeah. We'll bring that up.
Mm-hmm.
Also, we did Cloudbreaker Party.
Clubberger.
Yeah. So our 100th episode where we're sitting just came out,
yes.
And in it we say, "Oh, Clawbreaker's out now."
Right.
But what happened?
It wasn't out yet.
Yeah. Sorry, guys.
We had some difficulties with Steam. Charles had some difficulties with Steam because he's doing a lot of the work for that.
Uh-huh.
He had a hard time getting the Steam API to work in our game or something.
There was like one final bug fix or something.
There was one thing.
And then it had to go through the review process
right.
again, which is like a 1 week thing.
Yeah. Well, yeah. But yeah, they got back to us pretty quick and then we could just press the button whenever and press it on the launch date.
Mm-hmm.
The new launch date.
Yeah.
So it was only actually a couple days after the episode went out where we claimed it was out that it actually was out.
Yeah. So that's why I didn't edit that off.
Yeah.
It would have been correct after 2 days.
Yep.
But the party itself was really fun.
Yeah, there was a turn. It was two tournaments.
Yes.
And Steven got so salty.
I did get pretty salty.
He got so salty that Charles had to give him a salt shaker.
Yeah, I'm holding that. We should take a picture. No, we shouldn't. I'll take a picture of that. Never mind. But yeah, it was really fun. I had a good time.
Mm-hmm.
And like, it was cool seeing people get extremely high over Clawbreaker.
Yeah.
That was exciting stuff.
So, I mean, we know for certain now it's out.
Yes.
On Steam and Itch.
Yes.
So go break those claws.
Do it.
Ready? Fight.
Yeah. We're also going to PodCon?
Yeah. Yeah. I think so.
I mean, we bought tickets.
Oh, yeah. That's right. So we're going to PodCon.
Yeah.
It's in January, right?
Yep.
Of next year.
And we're not special guests or doing anything there, but we're just attending.
Yeah. So if you want to meet us and you're there, you know,
check
us out, let us know.
Yeah.
Tweet at us or email us or message on Slack or whatever you want to do.
So PodCon is its second year. It's like a conference / convention. It's kind of both, right? It's aimed at podcast fans and podcast creators. It's kind of a cool little hybrid. It's in Seattle.
Yes.
And it's in January. And we're all excited.
Yeah. It's gonna be real good.
Yeah.
Yay.
Should we talk about the Discord channel too that we added? The Nice Games Club Discord channel.
Did we add one?
I added one, yeah.
Whoa, then yeah, we should talk about it.
Yes.
I was like, Steven, didn't we learn to not promise things that haven't happened yet?
No, it's in there, I swear. Yeah. So on the Glitch Discord, we have a Nice Games Club channel now, and you can just post on there and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And it should be more open because the MSP game dev Slack is great, but like it's specifically for MSP game devs. So like,
yeah, it's open, but it's also like who would want to join?
It's really esoteric
the dev
stuff
here. So
yeah, so you can check us out on that Discord channel. We'll link to it in the show notes.
Mm-hmm.
And see us there.
It'd be great. It'll be a good chance to like talk to more of our listeners outside this community, which we've been really aching to do lately.
Yeah,
so,
for sure.
Because there's quite a lot of you.
So, Steven, how is modding Skyrim going?
There we go.
Brilliant.
Perfect transition. It's going great. I modded it yesterday too. I know, you know. You can just spend like 5 minutes, just download the thing, check it, see if it works, and if it doesn't, then just
see if it's a virus.
See if it's a that happens. That doesn't happen as often as you think.
It happens at all?
No, I don't think it's ever happened to me once. I'm pretty sure, but I don't know. Pretty sure.
There's probably something in there.
Maybe. So if it isn't obvious already, my topic is modding. And I've brought up modding a lot, I think, over the 100 and so episodes we've talked about things, because like I mod Skyrim a lot, too much probably.
Yeah, I can't believe that we haven't talked about this yet.
Right? It has been a long time.
Yeah, as big a thing it is in your life.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I didn't realize how big a thing it was in my life until I started typing the show notes for this.
Yeah.
Like, that's a lot of notes. I think I typed up more for this than I did
still
for
scrolling.
Fighting games.
I'm still scrolling.
Right.
I'm still scrolling.
Oh, boy. Yep.
Yep. There we go.
Okay. Yeah. So let's define what modding is so that people know. Modding is slang for modify. It's really just changing like the assets of the code or assets or the code of a game outside of what the developers initially intended. So like if there's like a level creator, that's not really a mod because like the developer specifically made a tool so you could specifically do things with it. Whereas like Skyrim has the creation kit where you can literally change the code and stuff. And they made the tool for you in Skyrim, but like you're still modding the game.
Because it's getting fuzzier because you almost disproved your point just there.
Yes.
Because that's a lot of moddable games now are intended to be modded.
It's true.
And a lot of the ways in are provided to you by the developer.
Right. Yeah. There's not a ton of games that are like specifically intended to be modded, but
like it's the difference between modding Skyrim with the Skyrim modding tool and something like Mario Maker, where you're like making levels and that's part of the game.
Right.
Yep. Whereas the average user isn't going to modify Skyrim.
Right.
And you have to download something separately.
You do, yeah. Mm-hmm. It's like a whole process. It's kind of obnoxious.
It's a fuzzy line.
Yeah. Right. And of course, I mean, really all the like those more modern tools give you is the way in.
Right.
You still have to do the work of the actual modding.
Yes.
So it's not like, you know, I mean, I'm thinking about like back in my day when it was a lot harder.
Oh, yeah.
But like, you know, it's still a lot of work, right? Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I mean, even with like games, most games do not like officially support modding.
Right.
And it's really difficult to get into those games unless you know what you're doing.
Yeah.
There are more tools available now than there were in the past, but like it's still really hard to do that. Mm-hmm. And you have to know what you're doing with it. Yeah. I want to talk about like the different kinds of modding because there's a bunch of different types.
Mm-hmm.
So there's like skin swaps and model swaps. Those are really easy to do because you just literally change assets in the folders of the game.
Yeah.
Most of the time. And that's just like, you know, making Mario's hat yellow or something.
Yeah.
Or giving your character a completely new outfit or something like that. And then there are level mods or user-created levels, which are not really mods, but like I put it in here anyways because they're kind of like mods. You just like, you know, you build your own levels and stuff. Like a new Tony Hawk Pro Skater level, and you can skate around the Eiffel Tower or something.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think that's in any of the games, right?
It probably is, but, yeah, but go on.
And then there are other mods, like gameplay and balance mods. Those are, you know, like... big scale mods, maybe small scale mods that like change specific properties of certain things. Like you can give an enemy 99 hit points or 0 hit points or whatever else. And then there are game revamps where like you take a game and you like make something almost completely different from it based off of the original game.
Mm-hmm.
So if you've heard of Project M before, that's a Super Smash Brothers Brawl mod to make it more like Super Smash Brothers Melee. That's an example of it.
Mm-hmm.
And then there are community patches, which are interesting because like they're just patches that actually make the game work on PC, which should have been done by the developers probably, but like here we are. and like a lot of newer PC ports have like community patches, like Nier Automata or Monster Hunter. Skyrim also has one.
Mm-hmm.
That game is gigantic and they wouldn't have been able to get all the bugs in there, so the community did it for them. And so, like, these are the way I listed this is I think about the difficulty in which it is to like make these things, because like when you're like really literally building a game from an older game, that's real complicated stuff.
Yeah, Well, okay, so you're talking about the easiest thing to do is to replace assets.
Yes.
And I remember when I was modding Quake back in the day, and the thing about it was really you just find it in your folder structure and replace it.
Like, yeah, you literally just
it is
do
so
that.
Easy. Mm-hmm. But like that is only as a result of games starting in the 90s that had that structure that were not compiled into the binary.
Yeah.
Right? Where it actually was just out in the open on your hard drive. Mm-hmm. And I think like Doom was probably maybe the first most successful like expansion of modding.
Yeah.
Using those sort of easier to access stuff.
Right.
I think they intended... Like, I think they fully expected that to happen. Mm. It was John Carmack is very much a believer in like openness, and so sure. I think that was built into the way that that game was architected.
Okay.
What was the earliest thing you got into? Like,
For modding?
Yeah.
I'm pretty sure it was Skyrim.
Yeah.
I haven't been modding for that long. I mean, I've been modding a lot during the time I've been doing it, and it's been 2 or 3 years at this point. But I'm pretty sure it was largely Skyrim. I'm sure I like maybe downloaded a mod and edited it here or there, but like it wasn't like a serious thing or anything like that. Just you know, making things more what I wanted in the game.
Right.
Nowadays with texture mods and stuff like that, there are tools that are specifically used to like inject themselves into the game and then replace certain textures.
Yeah.
Instead of like you having to replace it. But like all you have to do is download the tool and just have it up when you play the game.
Right.
So and it's pretty simple.
And all that really it just shortcuts the process of like unzipping an archive, digging through and finding whatever it's you know,
right,
it just makes the tedium a little less. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So like that's how we're doing it nowadays, I suppose. But yeah, I think that like I mainly modded Skyrim when I started. Yeah.
And I'm like, oh, Skyrim's not that old, but Skyrim's pretty old now.
Oh yeah, it's like 8 years old. No, later, older than that. I don't know. Mm-hmm. Well, it's real old. Yeah. In terms of like actually being able to mod things, it's pretty difficult because you have to get into other people's code and figure out how the heck it works. And like, I code games, and I know that like I'm coding stuff specifically for me, and barely anybody else can read my code half the time. So, trying to figure it out like being outsider looking in and trying to figure it out so you can put your own things in there is really difficult.
Mm-hmm.
So there are specific games that are like designed so that like modding is really easy. So Skyrim is an example, but like Torchlight or The Witcher, a lot of large open world games have modding
Witcher.
Yes. Have modding tools available so that like you can much more easily get into the code and make your own thing.
Mm-hmm. Is a lot of that like the configuration is stored in like JSON or XML files or something, or is it like decompiling DLLs and stuff?
They have with Skyrim specifically, like they have their own file systems, and they just give you the tools to open the file systems and adjust the file systems.
Okay.
I'm not exactly sure how other ones do it. A lot of them actually will, they'll have like allow you to make your own packers or something, and then you could build your own assets and then put those replace what they have with your own assets and stuff like that.
Yeah.
So it varies game to game, but I imagine it's not. If you do it from the beginning of your process, I imagine it's not too difficult to like actually add modding support.
Mm-hmm.
I have not done that for any of the games that I've worked on, but like that would be pretty cool, right?
Yeah.
Vengeance mods.
Ooh. Yes.
Well, I mean, that's a game with numbers. Like you could put a lot of that configuration out. Are you using scriptable objects?
For some things, but not for numbers.
Yeah, that might require a huge revamp, but like having that all accessible and then making that just plain text for people to monkey with.
Yeah.
That'd be fun.
That would be pretty fun. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I would be really excited to see like what would happen if we modded it. Like we could mod Cloudbreaker or have people mod Cloudbreaker and see what they would come up with. They'd make hermit crabs for us.
Oh yeah. Oh my gosh, yeah. Mm-hmm.
That would be really hype.
All the people would come up to us and be like, oh my God, you know what this game needs?
It's true. Somebody said they wanted a dog in the game for some reason.
Because there's a gif of a dog like trying to play with a crab and the crab's like, what? No, stop.
Yeah, that's right.
Why you do this?
I was like, we could have a dog as a final boss or something. That'd be pretty cool. Yeah. So aside from that though, like you have to download tools specifically designed to like insert textures and whatever else into your games.
Mm-hmm.
They're not hard to come by. You just have to know how to use them. And there are a lot of tutorials out there and stuff available for you to figure that out if you're interested.
Yeah.
There's also the cheat engine, which it accesses specific values in the code that you can change.
Mm-hmm.
So like you can change The website itself specifically says it's useful for single player games, but people.
So this is a tool, the generic tool.
It is a generic tool. You can use it for everything, and I think you like literally build scripts that you use to that you open up and start up when the game is running, and it'll just change the values for you.
Oh, so it's a game genie.
Yeah, kind of.
Right. It runs. It changes code at runtime.
Yeah, that is what it does. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So yeah, it's really cool because like if like this game is too easy for you or too hard for you, you can adjust the values to make it as difficult or not difficult as you want, mm-hmm. Which is really cool. And you can also use it to like, oftentimes you can use it to swap models or whatever else that are already in the game. Like if you want to play as, I don't know, an orc, mm-hmm. you can already play as an orc in Skyrim. A troll.
I want to play as Luigi in Skyrim.
Hey, yeah, there are plenty. Is there a Luigi? There should be a Luigi mod. Somebody get on that if there isn't already. yeah, so like there are plenty of options available to mod things in mm-hmm. particular. And it's I find it really enjoyable to mod things, largely because like you get to create your own game, sort of. Mm-hmm. That's why I really like Skyrim in particular, because it's like a huge triple A open world game, and you can build basically, if you get into modding, you can build your own thing with it. You can basically make your own game. Mm-hmm. There are a lot of like huge mods for Skyrim that effectively make new games or even like add-ons to Skyrim that add so much depth to the game. And it's really awesome that like that there's such a big community out there for it. It's really exciting stuff.
Mm-hmm. You haven't played Skyrim until you've played Skyrim as Master Chief, who also has Dishonored powers.
Yes. Exactly. So also with mods, there are a lot of different, I guess, controversies related to it, because like
dun dun dun.
This is, your modding controversies section is huge.
Yeah, I have a whole story that I kind of want to get into. Maybe it's probably gonna be like a 15 minute long thing. I don't
all right
know.
Buckle up.
Yeah, buckle up for sure. Yeah, but so there's a lot of different things. Like, for example, Bethesda in particular is very often trying to profit off of their mods that people make, because like so many people mod their games and they build support for it. Mm-hmm. So Bethesda's trying to get a piece of that pie. The community oftentimes is not having it.
I was saying, what pie? Like, is there a lot of sales?
There's no sales. So the thing about modding is very... like everybody thinks that it should be like free for everybody, mm-hmm. available, because like people are just doing it on their own time. They're not getting paid to do it.
Right. That's the spirit of it. It goes way back. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. But like, because there's so much content going out there and there's so many popular mods and things, like Skyrim wants a piece of that. Skyrim. Yeah. Bethesda wants a piece of that. And so like, the case, I think this must've been at least 5 years ago. I think Bethesda had tried to, sell certain mods, mm-hmm. like get people to get their mods like on their sales or something,
right? Like with like an app store model,
yes,
like a 70-30 or something like that.
Yeah, yeah. And the community was just outraged about it, because like nobody wanted to do that. Mm-hmm. And in fact, there was this icon called it had Forever Free on it, and for the longest time, I didn't know about the controversy enough when I was modding it. For the longest time, I thought it was a company or a group of modders or something.
Right.
I didn't understand what it was. But it's just an icon that says that this mod will always be free no matter what.
Yeah.
Like, they're not going to... Bethesda's not going to get into their pockets.
Right.
And so that was a big controversy back then. But now Bethesda has changed it. So, like, they're specifically hiring mods to build content for them, and then they sell that on their own.
Right.
Which is a different thing. Cause
as like a DLC, just a standard.
Right. Yeah. So like they're hiring people to make stuff for them, which is,
right,
I think is a lot better.
That seems, that seems like a more sort of ethical approach.
Yeah. And sure. People are much more supportive of it. Yeah. There's a particular mod called the...
Cause it is professional work.
Yeah.
To an extent. Yeah.
Yeah. If they're going to pay for it, it's got to be because they're getting a job and not because they're doing it for funsies. Otherwise it ruins it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. Exactly. There's a particular mod, the survival mode. I think it basically takes Skyrim and it adds like the Fallout 4 survival or the Fallout 4 survival mod stuff, where like you have to sleep after a certain time and eat and drink and all this other stuff. Mm-hmm. And it's pretty popular. There are a lot of mods that like specifically are supported with that
mod
in mind. So yeah, that's working a lot better for them.
So there's this like cross-pollinization of different ideas mm-hmm. in these things. I think that's the problem I have with it, there being like a marketplace for them.
Yeah.
Is that it's really hard to then divvy like who actually is responsible for this product.
Yeah.
Right? Because it's there's so many things people give away and share with each other, and someone decides to sell for $3. It's like, is that fair?
Right. Yeah. Right? I think that was a lot of it. And like it also gets into a little bit about like how people feel about like mod ownership.
Yeah.
Because when you create a mod, you would think that you own it. But there are different, like, I guess, schools of thought with this in this aspect. There's the cathedral thought and then the parlor kinds of thought. Cathedral is that, like, everybody contributes to a mod, in which case, like, everybody will put their little assets in or whatever else or support or whatever it is. And so whenever somebody makes a mod, like, it should be open for everyone. You can't take your contributions back mm-hmm. because that's not how it works. Like you put this thing in here for this. Like if you were building a cathedral and you built stained glass windows for it, you can't all of a sudden say, hey, no, those stained glass windows are mine. I'm taking them back. It's not how it works.
Right.
It's part of the whole.
Yeah.
And so as a result, if you believe in cathedral style modding, then like you're building something together,
mm-hmm.
which I like that idea personally too. Yeah. I think that like that makes more sense personally, but there's also the parlor mod idea where like you're opening up your mod to other people so they can see it and experience it. But at any moment you can say that you can close it off to people and prevent others from looking at it or using it if mm-hmm. they want. Like so that as a result you have creative control over that mod.
Yeah.
And so on the other hand,
these are basically mapped pretty well to different open source licenses, right?
Yeah. Yeah, actually
like MIT versus Apache versus whatever.
Yes. Right? I don't know a lot about open source mod licenses, but that does sound very similar. There are literally licenses and mods like yep. this. So, and they'll follow these ideals.
Hmm.
Another controversy that oftentimes will come up in these kinds of things is like mod ownership, specifically like you're taking content that game developers made and you're making your own things with it.
Right.
And oftentimes when it's like model swaps or texture swaps or whatever else, those are like minor things. Mm-hmm. And those a lot of people don't feel too bad about that or feel strongly about that.
Yeah.
But when you're taking a game and you're making a completely different game out of it, that's when it causes controversy. So, for example, Project M in particular is a brawl mod, like I brought up before, it was really popular because people can't get over Melee, like they had tournaments and stuff with this mod in mind, and it was starting to build a really big scene, and I think it was starting to dwarf Brawl's competitive scene for a moment.
Which was already not that
big. It was pretty small, yeah. And Nintendo noticed that, and I think they were trying to be nice about it, and they like weren't specifically saying, we don't support this at all, but like they kind of shut down the community in a way.
Yeah.
They didn't support it. They didn't officially support it, and they kind of started taking down Project M tournaments, I believe.
Mm-hmm.
And so now that games, that mods community is all but dead because people have moved on and they're playing the new Smash games,
mm-hmm.
Which are Nintendo supported as much as Nintendo supports fighting games.
Right.
And so it was unfortunate because a lot of people really liked that mod, mm-hmm. but it just wasn't sustainable for them. Right. So like this comes up a lot, oftentimes, largely because of Nintendo. But
well, you talked about how like different people contributing to a mod yes. have to decide amongst themselves what their ownership model is. But that's completely apart from the bulk of the project, which is this the company, and it tends to you tend not to put those percentages next to each other, right?
Yeah.
So like you make a total conversion of a game, mm-hmm. and a bunch of people contributed, but you don't. When you really sit back, you're like, well, is this 70% my work and 30% the original companies, or is it 90%? The original game and 10% me, and it's like I don't think that people think in those terms when they're modding,
yeah,
because it's not really necessary to think in those terms. But mm-hmm. when it comes to these elements of like, well, if you put on public tournaments, it's like, well, then it kind of becomes a copyright violation,
right? Yeah.
Like as much as Nintendo gets bagged on for it being overly litigious mm-hmm. about protecting its IP, because it much more than most Western companies are.
Mm-hmm.
They do have a point.
Yeah.
Like it's like they have the right to control their work.
Right.
And to an extent,
yeah.
Maybe they're not the best about how they handle that, But like it's coming at it from different philosophies when you're just considering different things, you know?
Right. Yeah. And I think, and in fact, I think like the Project M tournament started getting shut down because like Nintendo was starting to make their own Smash tournaments. And I think they probably just didn't want Project M infringing on that
part
of it too. Like, I don't think they cared that much before because like they don't care about tournaments.
Yeah.
They didn't. Now they're starting to run. Now they're starting to run their own and stuff. Yeah. And so it's like an iffy section of the game development.
Yeah.
Well, if anyone wants to run a Clawbreaker tournament, go for it.
Yes. Mod the heck out of it if you can. I bet that like Unity games aren't too difficult to mod because there's a lot of Unity games out there now. Y'all figure it out. Let me know. Send me your mods. And then we brought up before like mod licensing. So there's this role playing mod that I used to get on Skyrim called Requiem. It like changes Skyrim to make it way more difficult, and it makes it so that like when you get unlocked perks and stuff, it's way more important than like leveling up. It's a very popular mod for Skyrim. And it only officially works on the 32-bit version of Skyrim, which is the legendary edition, as opposed to the special edition, which is the one I use now. At any rate, one of the modders who works on this mod created a separate mod for Requiem because like they didn't particularly care for how some of the things were balanced. I think like they changed some of the armor stats and stuff. Uh-huh. Really specific things that are boring. But
they modded the mod.
Yeah, they modded the mod, exactly. Yeah. And so that modders some of that work was starting to get put into Requiem itself because a lot of people really liked it. And I think the creator, because they were working in a team, the creator of the mod, the person who owned it, claimed ownership of it, was working with them. And they liked that it was like these particular aspects.
Sure.
And so that work was going to be included into a particular popular update for Requiem, Requiem 2.0, I think. I can't remember all the specifics of it, but yeah. Meanwhile, there was another user who was really interested in having this mod on the 64-bit of Skyrim, the 64-bit version of Skyrim, the special edition version. And they noticed that somebody posted a conversion for the 32-bit under the 64-bit version of Skyrim, and on a separate forum.
Mm-hmm.
And then the owner got wind of that and demanded that it was taken down. They were more of the like the parlor mod kind of idea, so like they wanted complete ownership of the thing.
Mm-hmm.
The modder of the mod person noticed that and was not having that, and then changed the licensing of their mod so that like it stated that like you can have this mod in your game as long as anybody can have mods in your game and can mod this mod. And because they had
they tried to change the license of the thing they added to.
Yeah. Well,
it's pretty sneaky, sis.
Yeah, right. That's what I'm saying. They specifically changed the mod and they retroactively did it. And specifically, they did it right before like the big update was going to come out.
Okay.
So like they
designed to cause it was basically a statement.
Yeah.
Sure.
Right. Yeah. So they held the update for ransom until the owner either changed their ways or just decided to move on and remove the person.
Right.
And like they had to build it themselves, but it would delay the mod for a couple of months.
Yeah.
Or the update.
Yeah.
And so they ended up just kicking that person off the team.
Mm-hmm.
And then they had to re-update. They had to build the mod again, and then they built it, and now they're on Requiem 2.0. But like, it was a big whole controversy in that community for a while. It was really interesting to read up on it. I'm gonna see if I can maybe find a write up on it. Put in the notes that there's a
battlefield history of
news
from the front,
right? Yeah. There's like I'll find some notes for y'all to look at and see what was up with that. Basically it was these two like competing ideas for mod ownership in one scenario.
Mm-hmm.
Here that I thought was really interesting.
Hmm.
It was fascinating to see it unfold. But I have since moved away from that mod anyways, because it changes too many things, and I didn't like all of that. I like having more control over the game itself, mm-hmm. so I moved on.
Well, it's interesting you talk about like these ownership battles are totally irrespective of any commercial value that any of this has, because no one was selling anything.
Yeah, no one's selling anything, and nobody expected them to sell it.
It almost, it sometimes it when you're not making any money, mm-hmm. your principles are all you have.
Yeah.
So this person who is like, this is a thing I made,
yeah.
that I brought people onto to contribute to, mm-hmm. it's mine, mm-hmm. is a perfectly reasonable
right.
position.
Yeah.
And then the person who says, I'm contributing and in the spirit of sharing and you know, to this thing you're working on.
Right.
It also perfectly reasonable yeah. position.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. That's why I like that so much.
Like, they're not even in conflict. They're not mm-hmm. even two ideologies. Mm-hmm. Like, you could feel one way about one thing you do and another thing about another thing you do, mm-hmm. but it's going to clash.
Right. Yeah. yeah. And yeah, it was great. Actually, though, with mods, there are like donation systems and stuff. People have sure. Patreons and are almost effectively full-time modders, and they build mods okay. specifically for like Skyrim or maybe not Torchlight, but other things like that.
Yeah.
Which is kind of weird, right? But like, it's all donation based.
Right.
So like,
right.
people are like, they're giving them money so that they can keep making more mods for them. And
right.
change the
game. That gets a little sticky because, you know, then the consumer in that situation who's paying, what they think they're paying for is not what they're technically paying for.
Right.
And so those licensing situations do not acknowledge the consumer intent.
Yeah.
And so the relationship is not as known, mm-hmm. and that can lead to trouble.
Right. And also, like, in some of these Patreons, there are like, Patreon exclusive content where like other people cannot have access to it.
Right.
Which
and how is that enforced?
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. I mean,
probably not a lot of DRM systems being built in the modding.
No. It's basically just like locked behind Patreon system.
Sure.
So and I guess anybody can like just upload the zip or whatever somewhere else.
Yeah.
If they wanted to. So Mark, you said you had some experience with modding.
Yeah. I did a lot of stuff with Quake.
Okay.
And Quake 2,
yeah.
Back in the late 90s.
And it sounded like you largely replaced like models and stuff?
Initially, yeah, but there's two things that I really loved about doing that. One was level design stuff,
okay.
because there were a lot of tools that were released by third parties for that.
Yeah.
And I think we've talked about this in a previous episode, because I remember I dug up some images of these Quake mods that were commercial that you would go to an electronics boutique and buy. Mm-hmm. And they had just the worst box art in history. and so there was a secondary market for a lot of this stuff because id Software really support, like they just had this spirit of like, here's a platform, go ahead. I don't think they even considered licensing. They licensed the brand, right? Mm-hmm. So they like trademarks and stuff they yeah. would license. But I don't think they took any actual cut. I should look into that. I don't know that for certain, but I remember being very permissive. So I had like a level editor that I bought at a bookstore, like for Quake.
Huh.
I think this was just before internet distribution was super feasible.
Sure.
Frankly.
Yeah.
I don't think it cost that much. Mm-hmm. But yeah, so I would do a lot of level editing, and that was a lot of fun. And you can build whole campaigns. There wasn't a ton of like code stuff, but one of the things I really liked doing, and it required some command line compiley stuff, mm-hmm. was doing cinematics.
Oh.
Which is sort of interesting because now that when I make games, I'm not that interested in cutscenes mm-hmm. as a developer. Mm-hmm. Like, I'm not going to not include them in games of mine, but they don't seem to be, I'm not excited about making
sure,
them.
Sure.
But that I was like way into that, like making movies in Quake. And like, again, I think we talked about this in this episode because it's all coming back to me. But like, we talked about like Red versus Blue.
Oh, yeah.
And before that was a long running series of Quake movies.
Oh.
And that's where that tradition comes mm-hmm. from. And like just tons, you know, you think of like YouTube comedy, like just someone telling jokes with their friends in a way that is not like sort of sanctioned by gatekeepers, suddenly becomes popular because enough people like it. And then you have these weird sort of cultural niches that are formed out of just people's random imaginations. And there is a lot of that.
Mm-hmm.
It became inside jokes that more people were just part of. And it was a very cool community.
Yeah.
And it was definitely where a lot of, you know, I developed some of my filmmaker and editing chops mm-hmm. Doing that back in the day.
Yeah. That's cool. Like yeah. I've heard a lot of, modders like have gotten hired by the developers of the games.
Oh, yeah.
Specifically because they made this content and they were very impressed.
And a lot of times when you're working with some of these tools, you're working on a very specific part of a project,
mm-hmm.
which is something that makes you hireable.
Yeah, yeah, right? It totally does.
But I still used to do stuff with Well, with Quake, what was interesting about it, and the reason I brought up the cinematic stuff, is that when I started modding, I stopped playing that game.
Ah, yeah.
Because it became more about creation and stuff.
Oh,
and
yeah.
So it's interesting when you talk about, because your position in the modding community is that you follow it and you use these tools, and you're a player.
Yes.
Right? You use the tools to mod your copy of the game.
Yes.
You don't develop mods.
Mostly, yeah.
Because you develop games.
Yeah,
That's where you scratch that itch, right? But then I'd be really curious to talk to some of the more higher profile mod creators, mm-hmm. and find out what is their relationship with the game itself.
Yeah.
You know, because I remember just when I was creating things, I lost all interest in playing the game, because that's not what it was about anymore.
Right.
You know?
Yeah.
But the other one was, is Myst Online, which I've talked about on the show before. They, had a very, fraught relationship with modding, because, in the storyline of Myst, someone writes a book, and then that describes a world, which the theory is in universe that either you're creating the world or you're describing something that exists somewhere with your imagination, and then you can travel to that world. So it's perfectly suited for modding, an in-universe example.
Yeah.
And so, but because it's a created universe with lore,
right.
You can't just let anyone add to it.
Oh,
and so it was a very, it was a lot of things that was very interesting. And I was involved in that community for a long time. As those tools were being developed, mm-hmm. and making stuff in Blender and writing Python scripts, mm-hmm. Which was not fun, because that engine was pretty old by the time we got our hands on it.
Yeah.
But that was really cool. But that really fizzled out because it never really knew what it was.
Sure.
You know.
Sure.
Whereas like a community around Skyrim or like Rain World, there's a couple of these other high profile modding communities. Like they have an identity.
Yeah.
And that really lets them thrive. Mm-hmm. Right.
Yeah. And like they're specifically like the developers support it.
Oh yeah.
And I think that's a lot of it.
And deciding what that identity is, mm-hmm. is a shared responsibility.
Right.
Right. That's where it didn't work with Myst Online, is because there couldn't be a full agreement between the creators and the players on what it should be. Mm-hmm. And that's really no one's fault. I think that property just had too much potential, but there wasn't really a perfect solution for it.
Sure.
You know.
Yeah. We have a few people in our community who mod pretty frequently.
Yeah.
Maybe we should try to get them on the show and see, mm-hmm. what they think.
It's a good idea.
Yeah. Martha, have you done mods before?
I mean, I haven't made any, but I have used like Stardew Valley. At first I couldn't do the fishing very well, and so someone had made a easier fishing mod. Well, there's easier fishing mod and then the easiest fishing mod. One made it so you didn't have to do any mini game at all. Basically the fish always stayed at the bottom, and so you just, so I didn't do that one because I was like, I still want to play the game. So I got the one that the easier fishing mod, which was just it made the fish go up and down less, so you could follow it easier. Mm-hmm. And yeah, that game looks like it would be pretty easy to make mods for, because like everything, you go in the folder structure and everything is labeled like really clearly. It's like fishing.
Yeah.
It's like fishing.js or not JS, but you know, whatever.
Yeah.
And so like you just swap the file out or whatever. And then another one is Minecraft has got like a huge mod community. And also now Microsoft has taken its cut and having like a bunch of mods on, like especially on the Switch, you can buy texture packs and stuff like that.
Oh yeah.
And those are community created?
I think they were originally, and then they like were like,
they like they bought the rights to it or something.
Something like
so.
Or like they did, I have to do more. I have no idea.
Yeah.
I have to do more research. But I think it's like, oh, these things are popular. We'll make something similar to them.
I think you can play as like Mario and Luigi in the Switch version of Minecraft, right?
Yeah, yeah. I think I'm actually really curious to see who is it that developed that.
Yeah.
Because like Nintendo will frequently let other people use its characters to create content for their things, but it's a very strict process. And Minecraft being a Microsoft property is such a weird example because it's on everything, right? Mm-hmm. And it like supports crossplay, and it's like it's so strange.
Yeah,
and yeah, has that a lot of Nintendo content in the Switch version, right?
Yeah. I think there's a whole lot. Yeah.
Yeah,
it's and you can mod games on consoles now. You couldn't do that before.
Sure.
I have not explored that at all. I just do it on PC.
Yeah, like Xbox is leading the way on that, right?
Yes, that is. So you can, I think you can also mod like specifically Skyrim on PS4,
mm-hmm.
but yeah, Xbox I think is the best version for modding stuff at. And like they have, like I think Bethesda like spearheaded something to like allow people access to it in like Skyrim or Fallout 4.
Mm-hmm.
And so like people can just download mods on there and stuff. And I think it uses fairly similar tools to how it is on PC, but there are some limitations. Like you can't use external software to like change stuff.
Right. There's everything is sandboxed
right.
on a console. So mm-hmm. there's whatever, yeah, whatever needs to be limited by that.
Yeah. Yeah. But otherwise, yeah, like yeah. it's great that it's way more accessible to people and they can make, and people can make their games the way they want them to make it.
Martha, there's got to be like mods for Borderlands, right?
Oh, probably. Yeah, probably.
Have you just not been interested?
Is Borderlands just too perfect to bother modding? Like,
right.
Yeah. It's perfect just the way it is.
Okay.
Fair enough. Yeah, you know, my brother is like vehemently against modding.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm sure I'll hear it if he when he hears this topic. But like, he never wants to mod his games ever. And like, I can understand like if you want to get the vanilla experience and then like mod it. But he just never wants to
touch vanilla
it.
Experience.
That's what they call it. Is like
of course
vanilla Skyrim when you don't mod things.
Yeah, yeah. Martha, I interrupted you a minute ago. You want to say something?
Oh yeah. Well, I was watching some YouTube videos and there's this one person who made. Like vegetarian Minecraft mod, and so like there were way more types of plants and like way more cooking options and stuff like that, and like the she made lots of new textures and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
For all, like there was cattails and all these really cool plants and stuff because like that's all you could eat. So that's pretty cool.
Mm-hmm.
Well, speaking of your brother, he has a level editor in
HyperDot.
In HyperDot.
That's true.
And it's interesting, like if he doesn't want to mod any of the games, and you know, I mean, I have a history with it, but like mm-hmm. I haven't had that urge in a long, long time. So I sympathize with him.
Yeah.
But like wanting to put tools in your own work, mm-hmm. so that's a different itch to scratch.
Right. Yeah. Cause like, I think, a lot of indie developers probably want like their community to be able to add content to their games and
right.
stuff and
build it's another way to engage.
Want. Right. Yeah. And so like that would be really cool to have, but like I think you need to do that from you need to like spend a lot of time doing it either from the beginning where it's easier to do it or like just, you know, spend several months making a level editor or whatever
for your games. Or just cross your fingers and hope that someone will decompile your game and figure it out.
That is an option.
You know, which
too,
is
yeah.
also yeah. But I think things are so easy that like people probably have less maybe I'm assuming, but mm-hmm. I think people have less patience for that these days.
Sure.
I believe that. I don't know. For Metro Nexus, I think I've talked about this before, like the different art styles in the game. I've wrestled with how to, because it seems like a perfect opportunity for like a Steam Workshop thing mm-hmm. where it's just you can upload your own.
Mm-hmm.
And but at the same time, I kind of want to have control over that.
Yeah.
Right? Like I'm more of the it's mine kind
sure.
of opinion, right? And so I've thought about it, but it requires some technical changes because a lot of those texture assets are compiled the way I build Metro Nexus.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of them are embedded directly into the binary runtime.
Right.
And I need to separate that out. And that's not a huge change. It's not a tiny change mm-hmm. in the way my game works.
Yeah.
So I don't know. It's like it's one of those things just in your back of your mind all the
right.
time. Like, how can I make this a little easier? And what decisions am I making now that lock me off from making it a little easier later or something? Mm-hmm. You know? And how useful would it be to anybody? And therefore, how much effort is it really worth?
Yeah, right. Because it's not an easy task a lot of the time.
Right. You said to develop sometimes a separate tool chain
mm-hmm.
that's apart from your game.
Mm-hmm.
You know? It's like we got to do it to make games, not develop software.
Right.
Right.
Exactly. Martha, what mods would you like for Clawbreaker?
Clawbreaker?
Yeah.
Oh, I mean, more crabs. Color
yeah.
swaps.
Yeah.
Like, maybe someone could put in a single player for us.
Yeah, mod some AI into the game.
Yeah.
That'd be great.
You're talking at the party about having different types of crabs with different, like, different types of claws, different skill, make it a class-based.
Yeah.
More like a traditional fighting game. And but the balance requirements would just be a lot. But letting a community do that would be really cool.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they can make their own patches for
hermit crabs, spider crabs.
Yeah,
those crabs with one big claw and one little claw.
Yeah, I really like that too. Oh, I wonder if we could get like the different fighting game archetypes in the Clawbreaker. We can have like a grappler claw crab.
No, don't worry about archetypes. Aww. Design your own.
Yeah, I guess we could. Yeah.
We'll set the new standard.
Yeah.
Yes.
new standard. Don't make it like every other fighting game.
Oh, but I like every other fighting game.
Well, the thing that's nice about Clawbreaker is like when you lose a claw, then suddenly the way you control area is so different.
Yeah, yeah.
And it's conditional, and it's really interesting.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, I'm very glad that it came out the way that it did. Like it came out very well.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, even when I was sitting there in the playing in the tournament, being all salty, that's what I was thinking of. Is those kinds of strategies?
Yep, yep. Available on Steam and Itch, everybody. Go buy it.
Thanks, Mark. Speaking of Clawbreaker.
Uh-huh.
We self-published it?
Yes. Uh-huh. That was where I was going with it. Yeah.
Oh, sorry.
That's okay. You delivered better than I would have.
We need to compare notes before the show, guys. So we can get this right.
Right, yes.
So this is my topic. We tried to come up with some titles for this. So this might not be exactly what you're expecting, but self-publishing must-haves. And so Clawbreaker is out.
Yes.
And Widget Satchel, we just put, it was a couple weeks ago, but we put up all the Steam and Itch preview pages.
Yeah.
And I talked in a recent episode about preparing a lot of assets for console pitches. And so I think a lot of this I have just like piles of assets now, mm-hmm. for Widget Satchel. And it's true of Clawbreaker as well, I imagine. And so I thought I might want to just go through some of those, because it was actually it took a while to like develop that list of things. And now it's kind of just floating in my head. So it'd be nice just to get it out. So this is not going to be exhaustive, but it's basically just an idea of like outside of your game itself, like when it's time to get it out there, like, and this is not a PR thing or marketing exactly. Right. That's a bigger topic that we'll address later, I think. This is really just like what you need in on your hard drive to publish a game.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah.
Like, cause people, they need to know what the game is and stuff.
Yeah.
Like, as otherwise they'll just see the title of the thing and go, oh, that's a nice title, and mm-hmm. then avoid it. Or even not, like, they just, you can't see it. So like, you gotta see it.
Just the little things that you didn't think you needed to do until you realized you had to do them.
Yeah.
So this is just a quick overview of those.
Mm-hmm.
The main thing is key art.
Mm.
And so key art is a term that usually just means like, if you see like, it's like an icon or a banner or like, sometimes box art makes sense. It's sort of like the, I always think of that that image of one of the Overwatch characters who's like twisting around like a pretzel and shooting a gun backwards or something while like doing a flying kick. It doesn't make any sense. And I see that image all the time. And I know almost no other Overwatch art, but I know that game because of that key image, right? And so that's something you want to develop for your game. And it's going to really depend on the genre, what is useful for that. If it's a character, is it a setting, like a nice vista that shows the world? Is it, if it's a mechanical game, do you want some sort of metaphor or iconography to represent it, even if it's not specifically game art? Sometimes you can use game art, sometimes you use concept art.
Yeah.
But the thing is you're going to need this stuff because you're going to have to make dozens of different versions of banners and headers and cover images.
All different sizes.
Yeah, and so many more than you need. And like just Steam alone requires you to make, I think, like 15 different versions or something
of a banner. Yeah, I think that's accurate, right?
At like very specific dimensions.
Uh-huh.
And they're all really random ratios because Steam does not have his act together. I think that's the reason.
It's like, come on, Steam, haven't you heard of responsive?
Yeah.
For real.
Like, you can crop some of this stuff or you can do half sizes or whatever, but like they have these crazy dimensions. Anyway, you're going to need a lot of this. And so it's the way I approached it for Widget Satchel is using reusable assets. So what you really want to do is you want to have, and if you're the artist on the team, this will be your job. And if you're not, then you need to be over that person's shoulder and make it their job. It basically to take a lot of these things and basically make clip art out of all your game assets.
Yes.
Right. Or like color forms, like little things little vinyl pieces you slap on a piece of cardboard.
Yeah.
Like, and think of it that way. And then what you do is you take those pieces and you compose a scene. And then you're like, okay, this banner image is, 600 by 400 or whatever. And that's a round number. You're never going to get those. Mm-hmm. It's going to be some random thing.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so I'm going to arrange it in such a way. It's slightly landscape oriented. So I'm going to do this. And like the title, the logo type of your game is over here in the corner or whatever. Okay, now I need this other one. Oh, it's vertically oriented. Well, now all of this doesn't work. But it's all made of pieces, right?
Okay.
You don't need to complete new art for this. You can just reorient a little bit. And what's nice about that too is that then you have a sort of a key art template. Like you've seen this a lot where you see like this probably dates me, but like a magazine ad for a video game. Like it looks kind of like the box art.
Oh yeah.
But like not exactly like the box art. Mm-hmm. It's because they just use that process. They just took all those things and just slid them around until they fit in that box.
Yeah.
And so this isn't like a huge revelation, but like when you start having those things and are able to make a different thing very quickly, you'll really appreciate how valuable that is. And a lot of times people will think of this kind of idea and they'll be like, oh, I just need like a logo and then I can put the logo anywhere.
Yeah.
And that's not it at all.
No.
You need like a bunch of different things that you can rearrange and then and recontextualize for what you need it for. Because sometimes you want key art that does not have your logo in it, right?
Yeah.
Or your logotype, because where it's going to appear is going to be right next to something that has the title.
And and like things need to take up a certain amount of space. And because there are so many different kinds of like sizes and shapes that like people have things on their websites or whatever,
yeah,
like you're going to need different pieces in different places to make that all make sense.
Exactly right.
Yeah.
And a lot of these Steam examples, all these different sizes, they have very, they'll describe to you exactly where they go, what the context is. So you can design for that. But sometimes you'll be designing elements that have, will appear in multiple contexts. So you have to think a little bit about that.
Yeah.
And so you want a sort of a flexible kind of system. And you just want, you just want like one file that has all the parts that you can then rearrange and export to whatever you need it, whenever you need it. The startup cost of that is a little high depending on how you do your art and how you export all those pieces and how easily they are to separate from each other and actually orient. But you want a strong composition. So I think what I recommend is pick like a generic sort of banner size, like 800 by 600 or something, and then build something with that and that size. And then what'll happen is as you do more of these little things, they pop up, they'll get a little better, and then you'll backport some of your like little improvements to some of the earlier ones you did. And so that forms the basis of like everything, like the art on your website, the art on your store page. Like, when you do make like an icon for Switch, you know, and those need to be a little bit more than like a phone icon thing. Players want more of a key art for that.
Yeah.
All that stuff can all be built out of the same parts.
Right.
So I can't like, I'm like really stressing it because I think people are flummoxed by that process. That when they have so many assets to create. It actually isn't that hard if you sort of prepare a little bit.
Yeah.
Anyway, so there's that. You also are going to need an icon, which is different from that, obviously.
Yes.
Although if you're making just a PC game, it doesn't matter because all PC game icons are terrible.
Like, yeah.
They're
so tiny.
They're straight garbage because people just launch their games from Steam or whatever.
Yeah.
And, you know, that makes me a little bit upset that no one cares. But, like, no one cares. So as long as it's fine and people will, like, not confuse it for something else, you're fine. That said, you should put more effort into it because, you know, you have respect for yourself, for crying out loud.
And maybe to stand out and from other games, maybe people will play them more often.
True.
Positive spin.
But on the other hand, you're making a mobile game, that icon is the most important thing. The most important thing. And it's outside the scope of this topic to really give you a lot of advice on what makes a good icon, but there's tons of resources online for, you know, the do's and don'ts of that kind of stuff. Like, for example, I think the main thing you want is a guy with a mustache yelling and looking to the right, right? Isn't that what you want in an icon?
Yeah, the upper right corner.
Yep, that's what you want in all your icons.
Yep.
So just follow those rules and you'll be fine. Mm-hmm. But seriously, though, like that's something that like matters a lot. Like the it reproducing the different sizes and scales. And there's tons of resources online for that. So that's not, again, it's a little outside the topic here, but it is important, especially if you're on mobile. But I think take it seriously no matter where you're publishing, for sure. Last thing in this category is GIFs. You want to have a little animated doodads.
Oh, yeah.
And so it's really easy to overdo these.
That's true.
But I think, good advice I've heard and that I've seen in good places is on like on a Steam store page. You want like one nice GIF that sort of shows off your game, but doesn't do the job of a trailer.
Right? Yeah.
It doesn't have to show everything. It just has to be a little attention grabby.
Shows a cool moment or something.
Exactly. And the one we have on Widget Satchel, I'm pretty happy with, which it's very short and wide. So it's like a little, it almost looks like a banner ad like that. And so it's not too ostentatious. It doesn't take up too much space on the page, but it just shows the game in action. It maybe will have the user stick on the page for a couple more seconds and then get hooked by the rest of it.
Yeah.
Is the aim.
Yeah.
You don't want to have all your screenshots be animated, for example, because that's not doing you any favors, really. But speaking of screenshots, you're going to need a lot of those. And this is something you get advice from when you go through Steam, but I think it's true everywhere, is that you want screenshots that are legitimate screenshots. You don't want concept art or mock-ups or anything like that.
Yeah.
Because the screenshots are not just to sell your game. They're actually a sample of your product.
Right.
And players will notice if you just assemble the cool moment rather than actually capture it. That said, also, screenshots can be boring. It's like, okay. But you do want a good range of the experience of your game. You want it to be a very honest assessment of what it's like to play the game. So if you have a bunch of really cool character cutscenes, but that represents 5% of your experience. You don't want all of your screenshots to be from your cinematics, even if they're the best looking parts of your game. You want it to be more representative. Mm-hmm. I think the guideline I'll recommend is like get 10 good ones, but you're not going to need 10 every time you need to post a bunch of screenshots. Mm-hmm. More than 10 is probably more than you need. But 10 is a good number because then you can assess them and then you can take the best 6 or 7 and put them on your Steam page or whatever. And make sure you've got a good variety. Show off the gameplay. You know, and
very important,
and highlight mechanics that are unique about your game. If you're making a tactics game, then you want sort of a general, like, this is what a standard screenshot looks like. It's sort of generic, but then you also want to showcase, this is what's the unique mechanic in my tactics game. You want to show that off so it doesn't just feel generic. You want to give the full picture.
If your game has multiplayer, make sure you show more than one player in the game. So people know that it's a multiplayer game. Also, it's probably obvious, but don't like take a picture of your settings. That's not useful.
Main menus, stuff like that. Even if you're proud of that stuff, and like that, I'm a person who's proud of that stuff. No one cares. So.
Not in the screenshot.
Not in the context in which they're viewing your screenshots. You know, that said, if your game is, you know, has a ton of customizable settings, if it's like a, you know, like a war game simulator where you design your own scenarios, then maybe that would, the UX of it is an interesting screenshot. So it's all depends on what your,
game is. That's true. You might want to think about, if it's like a really hype thing in your game, you might want to think about putting it in the description somewhere and highlighting that.
And that becomes a feature you're highlighting. So it fits the same rules. It's not even an exception to the rule. So that's good. I think it's, it is very tempting to find the one screenshot that shows off the whole game. I think that can be a little crazy making. If you've got that, you know, bully for you. But I think it's better to have an arrangement because people click through them. And I think that's the experience people generally have when they, when they do these things. Or if they're laid out on a website, for example, you know, six is probably too many if you're on a single page website. But like three, it could get a good range of your experience of your game.
The first thing I do when I look at a game is look at the screenshots because it clearly takes too long to get to. to get through. So I'm like, oh, does this game look cool? It does. I'll watch the trailer.
It's also a really good time to assess, like, you know, your art style and the assets you have. And especially if you're doing this work before your game is finished, which is probably what you should do, and then revise it when, you know, it's it is finished. It's a good time to take stock and like role play a little bit as the customer and like, would this get me to play this game? Is the thing that's great about my game, because you know there's something great about your game, or else you wouldn't be working on it, is that thing being communicated through these screenshots? And if not, why not? Is it because it's like, oh, my HUD isn't showing really well here, and like, oh, well, maybe when someone's playing the game, it won't be as well either, and then, you know, that'll lead you to some insights, or like, oh, the art style really isn't selling what I need. We need some polish here or there or whatever, or I can't quite get a screenshot of that really cool action, because it happens too quick and there's not enough visual indicators. Like, the reason you can't get a good screenshot is actually a reason, something to change about your game in a case. It's easy to misinterpret that kind of information as you're assessing it, but take it seriously and make it part of your process. And the earlier you do it, the more help it can be to you. Next thing's a trailer, so that you're definitely going to need. The rule here is no longer than a minute. I think it's, this is, I tell this to people making films and making anything. And I think people have heard it a million times, but some people have not heard it.
Not enough.
It needs to be less than 60 seconds. If you can get it to 30 seconds, even better. Because truthfully, when you make it, you're going to insist that it needs to be longer than 30 seconds. And you're probably going to be right in a sense. But at the same time, 30 seconds is all that someone needs to make the determination.
Right.
You're not going to know exactly what to put in there, which means your thing is going to be closer to 45 or 60 seconds. Fine, people are okay with that too. But nothing needs more than 30 seconds to get the gist of. So make it that short. If you don't have video editing experience, get someone to help you. Also, you don't have to worry about, now, as speaking as a video editor, like, I can say the quality of your edit is maybe the third or fourth most important thing about your trailer. Particularly on Steam, on a store, right? You're thinking about, like, maybe I'm going to do some pre-roll ads on YouTube. Well, then that's a different story. But if you're doing, a gameplay trailer or something, really, you just got to get immediately to, this is just screenshots in video form. And it really isn't much more complicated than that. You show off the game, quick shots, as quick as you can make them while still getting the full context of the moment that you're trying to capture, so you can have a lot of them, but also not too many, right? Focus on what your game is unique at, and don't bother showing things that the player knows just by looking at your first screenshot. You don't need to, even if there's a cool element of your game, if it's not unique, or also if that can, that impression can be given by the other materials. It doesn't necessarily have to be in the trailer.
Yeah.
The other thing is you're going to want to do on-screen text instead of voiceover, because a lot of people watch these things on mobile with the sound off. Mm-hmm. And so that sometimes can be a bummer, but also it's cheaper, you know?
Yeah.
But that means that you might want to put a little more effort into, you know, animated text and design and some of that. And that, you know, that sometimes can be outside of a lot of people's experience. But it is important, you know, and it may be not exciting for people to hear if it's like, I spent all this time breaking my back making a game. Now I have to produce a slick video trailer. You kind of
yeah.
do.
Yeah. Nature of the world.
Yeah. but even if you're not going to do voiceover stuff, I think having the sound effects in your game really showed off, and having some good music, I think, is important. Mm-hmm. I think people, you know, they'll judge a book by its cover. And even if your game isn't very music heavy, you want something that's, the trailer is, either the trailer shows the music of the game off, right? And that's an important part of it. So like when we did the trailer for Widget Satchel, Sarah made us a specific song from pieces of her score. Mm-hmm. And so we were lucky in that sense that we had something that had the feel of selling the game, but also was components that were of the game, right? And that's going to be true for a lot of games.
Yeah.
But there are some that don't have that because the design choices they made didn't lend to that.
Yeah.
Not necessarily because they didn't have a lot of great music or don't have Sarah on their team.
True.
Although that is a handicap,
absolutely.
But you're going to want to have something good. And there is a couple of ways to get some good sort of like theatrical score kind of music that's royalty free. Mm-hmm. A lot of audio editing tools have track builders in them that use a lot of the royalty free samples. Mm-hmm. Adobe Audition has this. And there's a couple of others. I'll see if I can put a link or two in the notes. It's, you know, it's not going to be the, you know, it's not like you're hiring Jerry Goldsmith or Hans Zimmer or anybody, but it can sometimes get you a little bit what you need if your game doesn't have the content to do that.
Yeah, there's that, what's it, Kevin MacLeod person whose music is like everywhere.
Mm-hmm.
That one.
Oh, yeah.
You just go there.
Yeah, that's. Oh, yeah. I'm thinking of a lot of like sort of constructing it, but you can also just go and find music you can use for
that's
free.
That's fine too.
But you know, treat it with a critical eye. Don't find the first or second or third thing if it works.
Mm-hmm.
Even though you're already sort of taking the second option by not making your own music, you're still putting together an artistic statement, and so take it seriously. And you know, if it's royalty free stuff, chop it up a little bit. See if you can make modifications if you need to give it some oomph for your presentation.
Sure, yeah.
Yeah, for sure. But yeah, 30 seconds is kind of 30 to 60 seconds. That's the rule.
Yeah, and don't make it too long, because if you make it too long, then just nobody's going to watch it.
Also, and like, I think we were sort of touching on it, but the thing that the mistake a lot of people make is the coming soon. Get ready. You'd never seen this. Da, 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 da. Like, yeah. No. You waste no time. Just immediately show like, here's the game. Here's what it looks like.
Yeah.
You know? That's what you need to do.
Yeah, when we made trailers for Fingence, initially we used to make, we had like a whole thing that showed off Escape Industries and stuff.
Yeah.
And I think it was like 5 seconds or something, and it mm-hmm. was way too long.
Yeah.
I think we still have the little intro in it, but it's like a second, and it comes in, Escape Industries goes away, and then there's gameplay right away.
Yeah, yeah.
Like,
and music really helps a lot with the pacing for this sort of thing.
Yeah.
Like, you know, you want to have, you know, like you do still want to have that ramp up
mm-hmm.
in a sense, but it can only be a couple of seconds.
Yeah.
But the difference between a 4 second lead in and a 12 second lead in is like the difference between like some, you know, half the people watching and half the half moving on. Right.
Mm-hmm.
But you have music, you can actually hook people and get them to go on. So like there's a lot you can do. And if you don't have the assets or the tools to put together something like that, it puts more onus on you to get there quicker and to be sort of no nonsense, just the facts. The worst thing you can do is make something that's beyond your capabilities, right? I don't know how cruel of that is, but like you think of like, you know, when someone makes like green screen in their backyard, like that can lead to some really fun, cool stuff.
Yeah.
But you can't make Star Wars doing that.
Right.
But and so if you try to, it's going to look worse. But if you try to make something in the scope of what you've got, and you're a game developer, you know all about scope and how not to follow it.
Probably.
So you'll be familiar with this idea. So you know what your limitations are for a lot of these things, and this includes things like key art too. Like, you know, if your game is very minimalist design, but you need a lot of this stuff, well, you know, think about what you can do and be creative about how you can use the limitations that you have. And that's definitely particularly true of the trailer, because it's outside the wheelhouse of a lot of people who are making their games, if they have nowhere to, you know, to get it off to or to hire someone to make. That said, if you're part of a game dev community, you're going to have like half a dozen video people who are aching to work with you on something. Ask around and make some friends, because that can be really valuable and get you a lot.
Yeah.
Ask people who you don't expect and like, oh yeah, I have a little experience with that. You know, like, oh, I edited my sister's wedding video or whatever. Like, you know, cobble together some knowledge and some experience. It isn't as onerous as it can appear to some people. Mm-hmm. Okay. Store page copy. So this is the texture writing. So this is like, I think everybody's nightmare when they talk about marketing or social media or like your elevator pitch or whatever. I think what's nice about, and I'm putting these in this order when I'm talking about these things, because this is kind of the order in which you should work on this stuff, at least in my opinion. Because the more you think about your key art, the more assets you'll have for, you know, putting in your trailer, right? If you want to animate, you know, logos or you're going to need like a little piece at the end for that. So you'll have that already because mm-hmm. you did the key art, right? And then as you do that, you're doing the trailer, and that's based on this visual stuff, but also you're trying to sell the game really shortly. So like, you're probably going to be thinking of like coming up with like one line phrases to put on a screen, because you can't fit more than 15 words on a screen. And even that's too many, right?
Yeah.
So you're really close now to coming up with your hook, your slogan, the first thing you say, the one line description of your game. And prior to working on any of that stuff, you've been thinking about your mechanics and your design mm-hmm. and thinking about how in your game, this is what's most unique about it. But then that's talking about your game technically. So we had this with Widget Satchel, where Widget Satchel's main unique mechanic is that the collectibles have weight. Mm-hmm. So that the more you collect, the slower you move and the shorter your jumps are.
Right.
That's an interesting mechanic, but it is not how we're selling this game. We're selling it based on the style, and the slogan we have is, get widgets, build doohickeys, cause mischief.
Yes.
Right? It's evocative. It makes you want to know what the next thing is. It doesn't describe the mechanic to you, because the mechanic described is super boring.
Right. and almost like, yeah, nobody wants to like be punished for collecting things.
Right. It doesn't sound fun.
It doesn't sound fun, yeah.
It is engaging, mm-hmm. and it is fun, mm-hmm. but that's not what is the hook is, right? And that's the difference between like what will keep people playing your game, what people will love about your game when they recommend it to friends, and what got them to play it when they saw your store page. That's a totally different concept, and the sooner you can get that in your mind, and when you start working on these little bits and bobs, you start thinking of your game in the context of someone who's never seen it before, so you'll be better positioned to write this copy. Mm-hmm. That's been my experience. I hope that works out for you guys as well. Out there. What else I got on this thing here? So this, you want the hook, you want the one line description. You do want to be thinking like a marketer, but you don't want to be thinking too much like a marketer. You want that one line, you want that opening two sentences paragraph, and then the rest of it, you want it to be like a movie plot review style description of your game. You don't want to get into the weeds, but you also want to do for the reader what your trailer does, which is show the game off, right? This is what you do in this game. This is your goal. This is, rather than being like the, you know, we worked for 5 years to develop this great graphic system and it's going to blow you away. It's like, people have heard that, but they don't believe you, right? That is interesting information. That's something you might want to tell an interviewer, right?
Or put it in a separate page of your website.
Yeah, or something like that. Mm-hmm. But really, when someone's looking at the store page, they just want to know what your game is about. They want to know how it works. And, you know, you want to zazz that up a little bit. You want to sell the game, of course. But you really want to honestly describe what it's like to play your game. And so I think that's the difference between other types of marketing copy, I think. You can be a little bit more in-depth with the mechanical descriptions, but not so much. What's nice about when you're doing a Steam page is that Steam will cut off your page after a while behind a read more button.
Oh.
And so that's a good indicator of if it's too long.
Did we hit that? We have a lot of GIFs in ours. We did?
Yeah.
I think so.
Oh.
Well, I can look.
Widget Satchel has that, where if you click the read more, it after that is like the final bullet points.
Mm-hmm.
So this is just my opinion, but I think that if you can get it shorter than the read more and you get everything you need there, great. That's cool. But I think people do want, if they're interested, they will read more, right? That's what it's for.
Yeah.
But you don't want to have like more than 25% of your content below the fold. Mm.
If that, we don't have it cut off.
Well, hey. Congrats. yeah, I don't have any empirical data on this. That's just my feeling about you know how much people are able to put up with. And again, like the trailer, it only needs to be 30 to 60 seconds. Your description, you can explain what your game is mm-hmm. relatively quickly. And the things you don't reveal, you can hint at without describing fully. Because again, the person who's looking at it, the question they're asking is, do I want to know more and experience more about this game. The question isn't, tell me everything about your game.
Right.
Right. Because if they want to know more, experience more, that's when they buy your game to get that. Or, you know, read your online documentation if it comes to it. You know. Okay. So next bit is your website. So now that you've got all these pieces together and you've spent a long time hammering at what the right noun is and a verb to use in this slogan and all of that stuff, you've got all your key art, you've made a trailer. You've also made different versions of your key art. You have all these different assets. You have everything you need to make a website in an afternoon.
Yeah.
Without having to bother with like starting from scratch.
Yeah. Just take all that stuff and put it in a WordSpace or SquarePress or whatever it's called.
Brilliant. That's official.
I don't make websites.
Exactly right. So Martha did a topic a while back on websites for your games. So we won't get too in depth here. We'll put a link to that episode and you should listen to it. It's pretty interesting. But basically, just a WordPress site, pretty easy. Martha had great advice in that episode on the step-by-step of what you need to do. So go listen to that, to get all of that. But basically you want a brochure, basically. You want a one-page thing. And you don't want more, because truthfully, not a lot of people are going to be coming to your product through your website, but you want it there for the people who do, or for if you do get some press. You know, some people are going to not want to link to a Steam page, right? Because of their policies or whatever. So you're going to want to have a home base for that kind of stuff. The other thing you'll want on your website is your press kit. So this is basically just the clean, bare bones information about your game and your company. Now, this is something a lot of people forget about because, and we talked a little bit about this when we were talking to Holly about media relations, where when you try to pitch someone on your thing, they're like, okay, I'm excited, but I have no information about you. I just have your pitch, right? Like, I don't know, you know, what your company is, where you're based, how long you've been working on this game, the things that would be interesting to engage with, right? Or like, what platforms is this game on? Like, maybe that's not something you do in the marketing push immediately, but you want all that information in a clean, easy to read place. And a digital press kit is a way to do that. It's basically a website that's a little more boring and a lot less visually interesting. There's a great tool called Do Press Kit, which is written like a function. It's press kit, open, close parentheses. Mm-hmm. It's dopresskit.com, I think. I don't know. We'll put the link in the show notes.
Yeah, we'll have a link.
Vlambeer made this tool a long time ago, and it's just an open source.
It's a PHP script, basically.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, yeah. I was going to say it's a PHP or JavaScript.
And then you edit. There's like a XML file that you edit. It's pretty easy to. Even if you don't know code very well, you can look at it and be like, oh, this is where I put in the name of my game. And then you hit run and then it makes it for you.
Yeah. And it's also, and you've made your 10 screenshots. You put them in your press kit because and you want high quality ones because then the press can take those screenshots. They don't need to ask you for them. You put your trailer in there, all the particular things, contact, Twitter, all that stuff. Is available if you want to put your phone number, if that's something you're willing to put out online. Again, this isn't something that's necessarily public facing, but it is a public part of your website. A lot of times people will put the link to their press kit, which is like it ends up living as like a sub site on your website. They'll put the link just on their homepage because sometimes it's the easiest. You just want to make it easy to find, really. So yeah, we'll put that link in there as well. And you know, again, you've already spent all the time, you've got all these pieces. So it's really just putting together these things. That's why you want to do them roughly in this order. Okay, two more things before I get done with this topic. First is community. So these are the two things that are a little bit outside the scope of this topic, but I wanted to touch on a bit. When you're on Steam, you get a forum if you want. I think you can disable it.
Okay,
and that's a place where you can build your community. I know Andy Korth has talked about how easy it was just to have that available.
Yeah,
and that's how he is managing the community for Verdant Skies, and that's a really good thing. I've heard advice from Mike Rose of No More Robots, the publisher that just put out Not Tonight, that really cool Brexit game. His advice is have a Discord server. Apparently, the way he says it, it's the cheapest, easiest way to build a community quickly. You need all of an icon to get it set up.
Yeah.
It's pretty easy. Gamers are familiar with it. It's an easy way to go. And if you don't have your Steam store, set up yet, or maybe you're not launching on Steam and you don't have there's not a built-in community tool for you, Discord is a really great option. Those are the two things that are quick and easy. You're going to want to moderate that stuff, of course. But in terms of just getting it started, Again, you've already got all the assets you need to make whatever icons or stuff you need for that. And again, it's there's other ways to learn more about that stuff. And you should actually listen to our episodes on community management and media relations, both with Holly Harrison. We can put the links to those in the show notes as well. She has a ton of really good information on best practices on how to get started being in that headspace. Mm-hmm. Again, a little bit outside this topic, but something to think about as you start building your presence and putting these things together. Last thing is social media. This is, again, we're not going to talk about how best social media strategy, but you're going to want to have assets, not just for icons and banners and stuff, but to actually publish and actually deliver content. We talk a lot on the show about game dev Twitter. Having screenshots and GIFs of your work in progress. For indie games, it's really valuable, and it's also the quickest way to develop have content to mm-hmm. publish. But again, what your rate of publishing that is really up to everybody. And one of the things I like to say is you want to have a great Twitter presence and you want to be really on the ball, but you're busy making your game.
Yeah.
So what that's going to mean is you do not have time for this. So again, just like you don't want to make Star Wars in your backyard, you do not want to launch a social media strategy unless you have time for it. And so, it's a question of do I make a Twitter account for my game to promote my game, or do I make one for my company, whether it's officially, incorporated or not? Your game dev label, or if it's just you as a solo game dev, your personal Twitter is also fine if you are comfortable with that.
Yeah.
But I think we have a separate Twitter account for Knights Games Club, and even with three of us on the ball, it's not easy to keep up on.
Right.
Right. And it's and really the demands on it are not that high, but we always feel like we should be doing a little bit more. Mm-hmm. So map that to your situation if you're a solo game dev or a small team and someone's in charge of the Twitter account for your game and is also working on the game, 10 to 40 hours a week.
Yeah.
Be realistic.
Yeah. Really just, I think if you just make it easy for yourself, mm-hmm. Don't expect to tweet about things all the time, but if some funny glitch happens, maybe make a GIF of that really quick.
Yeah.
And take a minute or two.
Use the game dev hashtags while you're developing.
Yeah.
Because that can be a source we talked about on the show, sort of personal validation. Mm-hmm. It's not really a marketing tool yet until later. But if you have to promote your game on your personal Twitter, because that's the account you have on your phone, it's the one you monitor, and that's the easiest way, it's maybe not ideal. Mm. But if that's how you can make it work, don't try to overextend yourself.
Yeah.
Well, I know Ooblets, those developers specifically decided we're going to do it on our own because mm-hmm. they had more followers and they didn't want to have to build up another follower base. And it actually proved way a better strategy for them to choose their personal accounts because they had already had a following there.
Right. Right. Yeah. That's an excellent point. Building that up is the job.
Yeah.
Okay, yeah, and if you already have one, then it might actually be the best strategy for you.
Right, and if your following is just a couple of dozen or a couple of hundred people, that's still a following. That's mm-hmm. more than your game account has. So right. Especially if you're not going to be tending to it as much as your personal one. So there's trade-offs. If you're particularly active on Twitter in a particular issue or another hobby that is going to conflict with that message, then you got to think about, well, maybe I change what I talk about when you have this time for this or whatever. And you come, or you just be like, you know what? People can deal with my other thoughts, you know? It's going to be up to you how to handle that. But again, just like with the other things, don't overextend yourself. Mm-hmm. And that's the key for all this stuff. It's these are just the must-haves, the assets you need. And as long as you sort of plan a little bit, it won't be so daunting.
Yeah.
And I think the main advice I have that I have learned is the order in which you do these things. I feel pretty strongly about that because it worked really well for Widget Satchel. It took me a long time to do it, but every step was easier than the last. Mm-hmm. And I think that will help you as well.
That's our show. If you haven't already, subscribe to Nice Games Club in your favorite podcast app and be sure to give it a good review if you liked it or are nice like us. We really need to know you're out there, so leave a review and tell all your friends too. We also want to hear directly from you, so follow us on Twitter and all the other things at Nice Games Club. You can also email us at contact@nicegames.club. Lastly, you can find more about the show, your nice hosts, as well as get all the links and show notes from this and other episodes at nicegames.club.
So until we start again, Remember to
play nice
and make nice.
So Steven's out of the room. We can talk about Star Trek.
So opinion about the new Picard thing.
I'm real excited. I'm expecting to hate a lot about it. But just because it's a new thing and it's a new thing, right?
I'm afraid.
Yeah.
But, you know, it'll be good. Also, I just hope they do it justice.
Yeah. I it's weird they announced it as a Picard show. Like, it's not like Picard is the most expensive of those actors. Like, why not just make it a Next Gen revival? Like,
yeah.
Like, how expensive is, you know, Kate McFadden these days? Like,
I don't know. Oh, did you know? Did I tell you this? That she was the choreographer for Labyrinth?
Oh, yeah, I knew that. Yeah.
Oh. Well, I just found a video of her, like, choreographing for puppets and stuff. Yeah. And I was like, that's amazing. Oh, isn't my cool? God.
Yeah, yeah. That's why in that episode where, you know, where she teaches Data to dance, it's because that one of the actor's talents, like,
yeah, well, I know she did tap dancing, okay. But I didn't know that she also did like actual, like, you know, choreography is different from actually knowing how to dance.
Yeah. Okay. Oh, Steven's back.
We were talking about Star Trek.
Oh. Okay.
Without the ones like you who work tirelessly to keep things running, everything would suddenly stop. Hospitals, factories, schools, and power plants, they all depend on you. No matter the weather, emergency, or time of day, you're the ones who get it done. At Grainger, we're here for you with professional-grade industrial supplies. Count on real-time product availability and fast delivery. Call, clickgrainger.com or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.